is side two of session number 42, recorded on June 4th, 2007. And we're finishing up with one particular LaRouche quote. And I was just saying that the popular cliche now of the military-industrial entertainment complex, McLuhan was writing about in the 60s and 70s, and LaRouche may not be adequate from McLuhan's point of view in understanding the element of getting truth out in such a vortex of military ambitions of entertainment itself. Now, so McLuhan said that advertising was a military operation, and he said if they gave him Madison Avenue, or if somehow Madison Avenue was recognized for what it was doing, it could take over the world in 5 years. That's what McLuhan said in the 60s. He kind of said, let me team up with Madison Avenue, and we'll take over the world in 5 years. So that is what McLuhan considered the real ground, and the ground was always a new environment that upset the older cultures, and older environments. Therefore, it was essentially an educational slash warfare militaristic operation. Any new environment was a militaristic operation. So that's, and it's not a militaristic operation in terms of obviously aggressive. It seduces people. It's a new interesting experience. It's just that people
Big
don't
brother
recognize
goes inside.
Beg your pardon?
Big brother goes inside, isn't that what he said?
Yeah, and well, that's the Anglo-American intelligence establishment that LaRouche is talking about. They actually get sidelined, and they're just managing the old 19th century issues like wars in the backyards of the world.
Oh, but what I meant by inside is they get internalized inside your central nervous system. They creep inside. You know, Big Brother is now, instead of, you know, hearing it as a voice outside of you or a camera watching you, they've managed to, through software manipulation, get right into your psyche and control you from the inside out.
Yeah, and don't think of it as getting inside your brain. They get inside your guts, your stomach.
Uh-huh.
If you think of a psyche, you're still thinking in literate psychological terms. The fact is the whole sensory complex is militarized or invaded, what McLuhan called a Trojan horse.
Mm.
It gets inside your proprioceptive and your whole landscape of interior senses. And
well, that really turns you into a zombie.
Yeah, well, you're a surfer. Surfing is great if you can do it, and anybody can do it loves the feeling. Well, people are getting that feeling by watching television.
Mm-hmm.
They can't surf, but they're getting the same exhilaration proprioceptively and kinesthetically and tactile-wise. So that is the seduction, and people don't realize how that affects their older media environments that they would consider their culture, and they lose their identity and try to retrieve it or form a new one. That is the social violence that creates the chaos that LaRouche sees as a paranoid environment caused by content managers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the argument between LaRouche and McLuhan.
Yeah. Do we want to say, now we've mentioned...
But I just want to say that LaRouche is right. I mean, Kissinger and them would not admit that McLuhan was right. So there's the conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what were we going to say?
Well, we've been talking, we've been playing McLuhan off of LaRouche, and then we brought in Croker a little bit with his panic. Does Thompson have anything to say about this period that's relevant?
Yeah, he talks about LaRouche. We had him talking about LaRouche.
Well, right, yeah. But not agreeing with LaRouche.
Right. Well, he sees LaRouche. Thompson agrees that there is a global management, a trilateral commission, that kind of view, and he calls them technocratic, and he says that they're erroneous. He maybe wouldn't limit it to the Anglo-British intelligence legacy, but he sees a global management that is not farsighted, but the very issues that he thinks need to be protected, the environment and population explosion and all those things, are the very things that LaRouche thinks that the bad guys are creating.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks Thompson would seem to... LaRouche doesn't think that being concerned about the environment along the terms of Gaia and preserving nature can be done by stopping technology. Thompson sort of feels that way, or thinks that the technology could be better if a different conceptual framework was brought to it. Yeah. So Thompson disagreed with what he called big science. He's
a little bit more of an environmentalist.
Oh yeah, he's an environmentalist. So
he's the whole Earth catalog guy.
Yeah. So Thompson is critiquing Anglo-American corporate intelligence for ignoring the environment, and LaRouche is critiquing Anglo-American intelligence for creating people like Thompson who are propagating and getting people worried about the old environment.
And Stuart Brand.
Yeah, that world. LaRouche sees Stuart Brand and them as major agents of the evil Anglo-American establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Thompson and Brand, they critique the Anglo-American intelligence establishment and think that establishment is counter the environmentalist agenda.
Right, and you've sort of lumped them in with the Prince Charles faction in some of your thoughts.
Well, Prince Charles seems to support the Thompson Quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's an organic farmer and makes public criticisms of modern architecture, and generally seems to be a guy wanting to get back into the agricultural,
right,
holistic past or something.
Yeah.
I mean, his family does apparently use homeopathy and alternative medicine.
Right.
But the LaRouche sees Prince Charles as a major element in Anglo-American propaganda, like almost the Antichrist, whereas Thompson sees Prince Charles as an ally against the Antichrist being MIT and the global technocratic structure.
Mm-hmm. Does LaRouche like the MIT global technocratic structure?
No, he sees them as enemies too.
Yeah.
But he doesn't...
Aristotelian.
Yeah, they're not Platonic corporate guys. They don't go for the healthy big science. They're bad big science.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Thompson is against big science.
Yeah.
Or at least the management of it and the rearview mirror concepts brought to it. Like Thompson is anti-monocrop agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And he was against the Green Revolution. He said that was a failure.
Mm-hmm.
Or he projected that it would be a failure. We're looking at LaRouche is complaining about the word that makes a market and says that people are being seduced by their own immaturity and need for paranoid scenarios. So it's kind of a top-down and bottom-up mixture. He's saying the peddling of paranoia is the main environmental effect through the media propagandists.
Mm-hmm.
The content keeps shifting, and if they get caught out on any particular story, they'll bring in an expose and claim that that's been cleaned up.
Right.
But they never explain the fact that they're using the medium of emotion, of paranoia. So it's almost like LaRouche is seeing the medium is a message, but the medium is a particular tribal paranoia. It's an emotion. A group emotion, what he would put down as pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees the creators of pop culture as working hand-in-hand and employable by Big Brother.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's go on to the next quote, which is an example of one famous guy that LaRouche doesn't like, Bob Woodward.
Well, just before we go on to that, I just wanted to one more thing. He's not a member of your book here, David Worster, but you were pretty close to him. What was David Worster's take on this period in terms of these power dynamics?
Well, the general insight Worster had is that...
And he represented the cosmic awareness.
He'd be in the Thompson Quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
On the chart, he's represented by Krishnamurti. But Worster, he was different and unique and almost eccentric in how he dealt with the Thompson Quadrant. But I don't want to go into that right now. I'll just say that one of the main things Thompson or Worster talks about, which Robert Guffey got a big insight from, and used in some article he wrote for Paranoia magazine a few years ago was the fact that Pavlov, the famous Russian or Soviet experimenter in conditioning, stimulus response, conditioning of the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's him who discovered, or people who followed up on Pavlov, according to Worster, discovered that the more you condition people, you're vulnerable if they recognize they're being conditioned, because then they can't be conditioned again. And Worster thought that the Soviet brainwashing environment had gone on for so many years that the Russians were not brainwashable anymore.
Oh.
Because it's, in terms of McLuhan, it's the tetrad effect. They pushed a process so much, so extremely, that it flipped into its opposite characteristics.
Uh-huh.
So Worster's view was that maybe this peddling of paranoia that LaRouche talks about doesn't work in the long run, and by the second half of the 20th century was not working because the people had been deconditioned, had recognized the trap they were put in, and from that point on they're impenetrable.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently some Soviet psychologist discovered this or recognized this. But that's a side issue. That's what I would add about LaRouche. About Worster. He makes a big comment.
Mm-hmm.
He brings that up all the time.
Okay.
And I may not have got it exactly right, but I think that's, in simple terms, that's what he's been pointing out. Now, McLuhan would say that we are deconditioned from the radio environment, the first half of the 20th century, and TV conditions you differently. And so the old radio conditioning, the hot cell doesn't work, and so the soft cell comes in the second half of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So Worster might not agree with McLuhan, because McLuhan sees the deconditioned levels that Worster's talking about are just another kind of conditioning, but with opposite characteristics.
I wonder if that book, Death of the Salesman, represented the transition from the hard sell of radio to the soft sell of TV.
Yeah, no, McLuhan wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
He said that was the transition of the death of the hot salesman as cool television came in. So it was the death of the hot salesman, the hot medium.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out about 1949, right in the transition. It's almost like, you know, good art. It happened. The play surfaces right before the television environment. Television technology becomes an environment.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes an environment by 52, 53, but the play kind of anticipates the effects.
Right.
If you want to look at it chronologically. But the, what did McLuhan say? The death of a salesman flips into birth of a PR man.
Oh.
So the salesman's running around to the doors and Fuller Brushman kind of stuff, you know, knocking on doors and trying to get people to buy stuff based on your sales, verbal sales pitch. But the PR man is managing technological environments that are now given, that are cliches, and people are addicted to them, so it's just managing the image of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the cool, what LaRouche would call friendly fascism,
mm-hmm.
The cool way. So the PR man just manages environments which no longer need to be pushed. Everybody has acquired them, and now they're part of their makeup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when does Playboy come? Is it early 60s?
No, Playboy starts in 53. A lot of things started in
53. 53, yeah. Was that a feature of the television environment, that the whole sexual thing could happen?
Yeah, McLuhan talks about that. He used to write letters to Playboy saying that sex was dead, and that Playboy didn't offer nudity. It offered sculptural outlines, that the Playboy play, you know, centerfolds were sculptural, not pictorial.
Hmm.
They were tactile.
Oh.
In the sense of television dealing with bounding lines.
Oh.
And so television massaged the population into a different sensibility where they accepted what was before considered profane, you know, nudity. Yeah. Now became seen in another way, which was what McLuhan called non-visual sculptural profiling.
Hmm.
So he did a lot on that.
Yeah. Because before that, you had the pin-up girls. That would have been more like pretty.
That's hot.
Yeah.
And Playboy was cool.
Yeah.
So, and then he said, you know, Playboy even gets obsolesced by the TV generation around the time of the late 60s when people didn't look at pictures. They went around undressed, like at Woodstock or the whole hippie culture.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, and he said that was a result of the satellite, whereas people realized that they were wearing discarnate electronic environments and that their chemical bodies, their flesh, the clothing they had was useless because they were wearing new environments. So you didn't, you appeared to be naked,
yeah,
but you were wearing the electronic environments or the electronic music,
yeah,
of Woodstock.
Yeah,
that was your new clothing.
Yeah. No, but the tattooing and the body piercing is more a feature of the chip body.
Yeah, that's later.
But McLuhan said that the TV tattoos you.
Right.
So how come tattooing doesn't come in with TV?
Because the earlier effects of clothing had to be dealt with.
Oh.
You know, dropping your clothes.
Yeah.
And wearing the new environments. You could say that the tattoo effect of TV is invisible. And when the chip environment goes around the TV environment, then the TV effect becomes visible, and then people adopt it.
Oh, that's very interesting, yeah. Mm.
They always adopt, what becomes fashionable is always the phase back.
Yeah.
But it is conditioned by the present.
Yeah.
But it's the figure expression of it is always rearview mirror.
Why did pre-literate people tattoo and body pierce themselves when there was no TV or chip environment?
They lived in an acoustic tactile environment.
Mm.
That's they didn't
have
this. Is that
what the TV and chip retrieves?
They regarded that as clothing. See, they didn't
yeah.
have the sense of a skin-molded body.
Oh, yeah.
Skin-bound. We went into that in the McLuhan section.
Yeah.
They lived in transparency.
Yeah.
And so you would decorate it.
Yeah. But TV is post-acoustic, or I mean, tactile.
Yes.
Post-acoustic.
Yeah, well, but acoustic is very close to tactile.
Yeah.
For our normal sensory life, remember, tactility is not a sense. It's the interplay. So the closest sense to tactility is acoustic space.
Yeah.
That's what McLuhan felt, anyways.
Right.
Because of its simultaneity and wraparound and based on rhythm and beat, or almost like the tactile interval.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go into the next quote where LaRouche takes a particular hack writer, novelist, Bob Woodward, and lays out a book called Veil, which provides information on the CIA director, William Casey. And let's see what LaRouche says about that. Okay, this is from, where does this end? ER. Looking in the index at the back, ER. Okay, this is a book review done in October 16, 1987, which is actually 3 days before the great computer Wall Street crash of October 19th, I think it was, 1987. But this would have been written a week or so before because LaRouche's magazine is dated a week ahead, so to speak. So this is Executive Intelligence Review, Volume 14, Number 41. LaRouche writing a review titled Woodward's Book on Casey, A Blend of Fact and Fiction. And it's on pages 29, 30, 31 of that particular issue of Executive Intelligence Review.
Right.
So, Scott, this is a long thing, excerpt, but
right.
Let's go into it.
Yeah, and in this one, we're actually post-Harvest Moon, so maybe there's some beater stuff in here. We'll see.
Right, this is 12 years after the quote we just did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Having now established that Woodward's Veil, that refers to his book Veil,
yeah.
V-E-I-L, is an artful blending of fact and fiction, I come to the main purpose of this book review. Woodward employs the, quote, Fleming effect, I'm sure that refers to Ian Fleming,
right.
To accommodate more than...
More
than to simply falsify particular U.S. covert operations. The selection of arraying of...
The selection and arraying.
And arraying of facts in the book as a whole is a gross misrepresentation of the way in which intelligence operations work. I concede that many of Woodward's facts about U.S. operations are true, like an artist's colors used to produce a painting. It's the painting produced with those colors which is false. I also not only concede but stress that false picture painted is only partially the result of Woodward's conniving. On one level, the lower level, Casey did understand the detailed side of covert operations. On the higher level, professional Casey was the bungling amateur. We recognize him to have been in reviewing the net results of his reign as CIA director. Woodward deliberately misrepresents only those mechanics of covert intelligence operations which Casey understood very well. On the higher level, Woodward's misrepresentation is a reflection of his own self-confident ignorance. The post-war U.S. intelligence community, like that of Britain, has been a parody of the mythical gods of Olympus, but he spells it O-L-Y-M-P-O-S. The intelligence community as a whole is run by invisible men and women, chiefly men and women who hold no official position inside government. Advisory committees such as the old, quote, 40 committee, unquote, Reagan's, these are all capital letters, P-F-I-A-B-I-O-B, and so forth, are merely reflections of the overall direction of an establishment which exists independently of the control of elected government.
Let me say, are merely reflections of the overall direction by an establishment which exists independently of the control of elected government. So it's a shadow government, shadow establishment.
This establishment is a pastiche, somewhat like the late Meyer Lansky's corporate form of direction over U.S. organized crime, of various factional elements among the, quote, gods of Olympus, unquote. The establishment reaches decisions which determine the fate of individuals, governments, and nations. The official intelligence community merely executes the collective decisions reached within this establishment. The resulting situation properly reminds us of
Aeschylus's.
What's his name?
Aeschylus's.
Aeschylus's Prometheus Bound, and also of one of Goethe's most successful poems, his Prometheus.
Goethe.
Goethe.
One of Goethe's most successful poems, his Prometheus.
Yeah. In, what is it, Aeschylus?
Aeschylus, yeah.
Aeschylus. In Aeschylus, Prometheus warns the gods of Olympus that there is a real god, and that the Creator's world has embedded within it laws which shape the ultimate doom of whatever sets himself of whoever sets himself up as an Olympus in defiance of the Creator and his laws. So, under the establishment's rule, intelligence functions on three levels. One, choices of policy directions by the higher echelons of establishment itself, from which a man on Casey's 1981 to 1987 level is absolutely excluded. Two, shaping of implementation of establishment policy directives by committee-like formations composed of the designated representatives of sundry factions of the establishment into which Casey was integrated. Three, the shaping of implementation by somewhat freewheeling intelligence, quote, barons, unquote, at the level of Casey and below. Casey would receive directions from the highest level, which he could not challenge. He could participate in the shaping of policy on the second level and would carry out the choice of implementation of policy which was adopted at that level. Within the limits of that decision, a man at Casey's level had wide latitude to do almost anything he could get by with, within understood guidelines. Woodward's book addresses only the third lowest of these three levels, and generally runs to the underside of that level. On the lowest level, most current U.S. intelligence operations are pure, quote, psyops, unquote, in parentheses, psychological warfare operations.
That's what he described in the previous quote 12 years before.
Right. On this level, the lower ranking people, such as liberal news media journalists or entertainment media people, carry out these psyops, while the higher ranking circles on this operational level plan and coordinate the psyops operations.
So there's a description of how Big Brother operates, and that anybody that the public hears about, like the CIA director, William Casey, is at best on the second level, nowhere near the top level.
Yeah. So what's the level managing Casey? Would that be your operation?
No, world government is the level that Casey's in, according to my chart. LaRouche is trying to describe the solar government level, but he probably imagines it as world government, and Casey's on the national level. So LaRouche is a critic of world government. Uh-huh. That world government is already established, not waiting for
headquartered at the UN.
Yeah, no, not that. That's what people are waiting for or hoping would implement world government. LaRouche is saying world government's been here for 100 years on the secret financial controls and on the level of ideas and think tanks.
Uh-huh.
So he sees that as the world government.
The Venetian?
The Venetian oligarchy. And the kind of thinking their think tanks make into popular movements.
Yeah. But they're still operating at the bank and paper money level, aren't they?
Yeah, from my point of view, LaRouche is not describing the solar government.
Yeah.
He's describing the world government, and he's critiquing Woodward for limiting his expose to a guy who works in the national government under the world government.
Oh.
That's Casey. Works. And now Casey's aware of the secret world government, but that is not talked about by Woodward.
Yeah. Well, Casey must be aware of them if he's taking orders from them.
Right. So, I don't know. Is he saying...
So, this world government, is this the sort of international corporate interests?
Yeah. And based on older wealth, from LaRouche's point of view. I don't know if LaRouche is saying here that Casey is unaware of the think tank level of idea policies, you know, mm-hmm. Aristotle versus Plato. I don't know if maybe he's saying that Casey's not aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read this again, and stop me if we come to anything, or I'll comment on it. So LaRouche says, okay, so when he talks about Woodward employs the Fleming effect, to accomplish more than to simply falsify. So I guess the Fleming effect is putting in some facts.
Okay.
The Fleming effect is mixing a fact and fiction, I guess. Ian Fleming, the author of the James Bond novels.
Yeah, I mean, apparently he was a 007 agent, but then when he wrote his books, he, you know, mixed his metaphors.
Yeah, he was a spy himself.
Yeah.
For MI5 or MI6 or
yeah.
Something in there in British intelligence. I mean, Beter says that Goldfinger was based on the fact that David Rockefeller family took gold out of Fort Knox.
Mm.
And Fleming knew this, so he fictionalized it into Goldfinger.
Oh.
So Beter would say that Fleming was mixing fact and fiction.
Faction,
right. So here's the quote again. Having now established, so he's already been writing something about Woodward's veil in this review, but I just took this section. Having now established that Woodward's veil is an artful blending of fact and fiction, I come to the main purpose of this book review. Woodward employs the Fleming effect to accomplish more than to simply falsify. Let's see how to read that. Woodward employs the Fleming effect to accomplish more than to simply falsify particular U.S. covert operations. So more is being done here than just offering a lie.
Mm-hmm.
The selection and arraying of facts in the book as a whole is a gross misrepresentation of the way in which intelligence operations work. So I guess he's going to say that it's a distortion because Woodward emphasizes the third lower level as the main ground of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And takes facts to show that's what's going on. But LaRouche is saying, no, the second and first levels are being obscured.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, I concede that many of Woodward's facts about U.S. operations are true, like an artist's colors used to produce a painting. It is the painting produced with those colors which is false. In other words, the painting of showing just the third level. So two-thirds of the painting are been cut off. If we assume Woodward could paint that full picture that Rouch claims he can present. I also not only concede but stress that the false picture painted is only partially the result of Woodward's conniving. So he's going to say that Casey is part of this. On one level, the lower level, Casey did understand the detailed side of covert operations. That's the third level. On the higher level, professional Casey was the bungling amateur we recognize him to have been in reviewing the net result of his reign as CIA director. So he's implying that Casey wasn't, well, maybe aware of the second and first level, but wasn't very good at implementing what was necessary.
Did Casey come after Hoover?
Oh, William Casey is, remember, CIA director from 81 to 86.
Yeah. When's Hoover?
J. Edgar Hoover?
Yeah.
He dies in 72.
Yeah, so he's Casey's predecessor.
No, Casey's FBI. Hoover's FBI. Casey's CIA.
Oh, I see.
CIA supposedly is international, FBI is domestic.
Right.
So, okay, so Casey's a bungling amateur. Woodward deliberately misrepresents only those mechanics of covert intelligence operations which Casey understood very well. On the higher level, Woodward's misrepresentation is a reflection of his own self-confident ignorance. So Woodward is not aware of the second and first levels. LaRouche is saying that Casey was aware of at least the first of the second level.
Mm-hmm.
And Woodward doesn't perceive the second level accurately at all. So
how is it that a guy like LaRouche, who's outside of these agencies, is privileged to understand these mechanics when a guy working inside at the level of Woodward doesn't even know what he's doing?
Well, LaRouche is either a megalomaniac or he has studied so many intelligence reports and has good sources that he was informed to the other levels. He would say that his general genius intelligence allowed him to discover what was really happening.
Does LaRouche like Mae Russell?
Well, LaRouche never talked about her, but some of his people occasionally would call Mae for information, but they generally didn't take her work as big enough, grand enough on the scale that LaRouche's organization thought they were operating.
Did Mae Russell like LaRouche?
No, she never liked LaRouche. Until I later turned her on in the early 80s to some of the things that LaRouche was writing about, that was about what she was exploring, which was A Night to Malta and that. So then she started rereading his stuff.
Okay.
But she still considered him a megalomaniac. But she was, I remember talking to her when LaRouche was on Larry King about 1986, she said, that was very strange. LaRouche was this calm, cool guy, not at all like his newspaper, which is, you know, quite fanatic sounding.
Mm-hmm.
And so she didn't seem to understand how LaRouche might know how to present a different image in different media.
Mm-hmm.
Almost, quote, McLuhan-esque, you know. He knew
yeah.
how to be cool on TV and hot in his newspapers. That either Mae knew one should do that and was struck that LaRouche was able to pull it off and therefore was maybe a little impressed with that.
Well, did he have an instinct for it, or did he understand McLuhan well enough to be able to do that?
No, by the 80s, everybody understood McLuhan in terms of how to manage your image in relation to different media. That
mm-hmm.
was common knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know about the formal effects, but they knew that you had to be different, because people had been living with TV for 30 years at that point.
Mm-hmm.
They knew you had to be different on TV than on radio
yeah.
or in the newspaper. It was
yeah.
just instinctual pattern recognition.
Mm. And
most people think that's what McLuhan was about. No, that's a very tiny part of McLuhan knowledge.
Yeah.
But what were you going to say?
Well, you turned Zappa on to Mae Russell, and he ran with the ball, you know, going for the touchdown there, and even in front of Congress. But what did Zappa think of LaRouche?
Well, in the interview Bob Marshall did with Zappa, when LaRouche came up, they talked about it a little bit, and then Bob Marshall said, would you support LaRouche for president? Because Bob Marshall, I think, tried to show how LaRouche was exposing the same dope, ink, international drug smuggling operations that Zappa was interested in. And Zappa said, no, I wouldn't vote for him. So Zappa was not persuaded by Bob Marshall's attempt, not that Bob Marshall was working for LaRouche, but he was wondering if Zappa could see past his bias and see how he was working on the same level as LaRouche, but there was no way. And
well, Zappa maybe didn't look deeply enough into LaRouche to have an informed opinion anyway.
Yeah, but Zappa and LaRouche are real opposites. The very musicians that Zappa celebrated, the modern 20th century classical people,
yeah,
were the very people that LaRouche disagreed with. So basically, as I say in my mental Prince Charles, that's printed in the booklet for the album, Bob's Musicology, Zappa is an Aristotelian.
Mm. Yeah, but they're both sort
and
of
Plato,
yeah,
and
but politically
is Plato.
They're...
LaRouche is Plato,
well,
and Zappa instinctively noticed that. He would think LaRouche was too much of a Christian.
Mm.
So on the content level, Zappa didn't have to look deeply. He just had to look at a few things that the guy said, maybe see him on TV, and sort of see. LaRouche definitely wouldn't advocate the legalization of hemp growing, which Zappa did.
Yeah.
So there was an innate difference that wouldn't work. What were you going to say?
Well, I would think there'd be a place where they could meet, at least in the fact that they were both sort of fundamental constitutionalists.
That's right. And Zappa was for new technology.
Mm.
You know, he wasn't a Luddite.
Right. Yeah, he was pushing the new acoustic technology.
Yeah, and there were rumors that he was interested in Pons and Fleischmann, though that never got confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
Pons and Fleischmann's cold fusion breakthrough. Let's see, and I never got a chance to ask him about that. He had cancer by that time. Okay, so what we were saying that LaRouche, what were we saying about LaRouche?
Well, I was asking you about...
Mae Brussels.
Yeah.
And, the different responses, a lot of it's personality differences.
Mm-hmm.
But Mae Brussels, in the long run, didn't like LaRouche and was suspicious of him. And Dave Emery, who's followed up on Mae Brussels' work, really tries to point out the Nazi connections to LaRouche.
Hmm.
He's very suspicious of LaRouche. So to the degree May was, Dave Emery carries that on.
That what Nazi connections did Emery think he saw in LaRouche?
That's a long story. You just need to read Dennis King's book. The book on LaRouche came out in 1989 called The Rise of American Fascism, something like that.
Yeah.
It's a big expose of LaRouche's involvement with mafia people and far right wingers like Mitch Werbel and those people.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, the
some truth in your opinion?
Oh yeah, yeah. LaRouche was in the middle of all these different factions, left, right, center, mm-hmm, everywhere. He was like a tetrad manager.
Well,
on the street level,
Hoffman was kind of like in that situation.
Who?
Jimmy Hoffa.
What about him?
Well, he sort of had to play off the mafia and the politics, and he had to you know, get all the factions working for him to try to get his gig going.
Yeah, and Dennis King's book shows how the Teamsters, who were a mafia operation, and that's what Hoffa was the head of, how the Teamsters funded LaRouche.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so LaRouche is like a more educated Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah,
he always his newspaper, New Solidarity, and then became the New Federalist. It always supported the unions. That was one of his target audiences.
Did LaRouche like Hoffa?
I don't think. I think he thought Hoffa was a good guy who got ruined by the FBI.
Oh.
I can't remember. He used to criticize some of the reformers in the unions. He'd sort of jump around and be for the old guard sometimes, and against some of the new guard, or people like Jackie Presser, he was against. I'd have to go back and look at the articles. He flopped around there.
Yeah.
He was against the AFL-CIO, that's right.
Yeah. So in addition to being
he was against the AFL-CIO. He saw them as agents of the International Corporate Elite, British Intelligence.
What does that stand for?
American Federation of something, CIO, I can't remember, AFL-CIO. And that was a major union tradesman organization.
Oh.
And probably it organized all of them, so the Teamsters were a subset of that.
Oh.
And Lane Kirkland, I remember LaRouche going on about the evil Lane Kirkland in the 80s.
Yeah. So in addition to being a maverick, standing on his own 2 feet, it sounds like he hung around some powerful circles, LaRouche.
Yeah, influential tribal chieftains.
Yeah.
In McLuhan's terms.
Yeah.
I think LaRouche would criticize Lane Kirkland and the AFL-CIO as following Malthusian policies and not handling the post-industrial environment properly, not keeping the factories going,
yeah.
Therefore not helping the working man.
Oh, yeah.
The union people. So so we're talking about May and LaRouche, and what was before that? The world government and that.
Yeah.
So...
So LaRouche has a higher view than Woodward of the mechanics, but he doesn't have as high a view as solar government.
As my view, no.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, McLuhan would be able to see the solar government easier than LaRouche.
Mm-hmm.
Just because he thought and saw on a wider, more, some people would say, abstract level than LaRouche.
Yeah.
Though LaRouche is abstract in relation to his fellow union
right.
workers.
And when you get into solar level stuff, you're beyond the realm of three-letter acronyms.
Yeah. That's right. The alphabet soup, they call it.
Right.
So where was I? I want to continue here.
Well, I think self-confident ignorance was the last thing you read.
On the higher level, Woodward's misrepresentation is a reflection of his own self-confident ignorance. So LaRouche is saying that Woodward's still embedded in the national scenario, not seeing the world government scenario. The post-war U.S. intelligence community, like that of Britain, has been a parody of the mythical gods of Olympus. The intelligence community as a whole...
Why did he spell Olympus with an O?
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay, because I looked it up in the dictionary and it's spelled with a U.
Yeah, okay. The post-war U.S. intelligence community, sometimes LaRouche puts in those idiosyncratic spellings.
Mm-hmm.
That's a way of getting you to look at the word again, not be numb by a cliche, which if you recognize it and you're familiar, you might not think about it.
Yeah, well, I just figured it was probably a pun on something.
No, don't think so. The post-war U.S. intelligence community, like that of Britain, has been a parody of the mythical gods of Olympus. The intelligence community as a whole is run by invisible men and women, chiefly men and women who hold no official position inside government because they're interfacing with the world structure. They don't need to be limited to national government situations. Advisory committees, such as the old 40 Committee, in quotes, Reagan's PFI, AB-IOB.
What the hell's that?
I think it's the Presidential Foreign International Advisory Board.
Oh, okay.
President's Foreign something I is maybe International Advisory Board. I don't know what IOB is. And so forth are merely reflections of the overall direction by an establishment which exists independently of the control of elected government. So it's beyond national governments, right?
Yeah.
Advisory committees are merely reflections of the overall direction by an establishment which has big Aristotelian policy plans and Malthusian policy plans, right? So these advisory committees are subsets of the world government. Whenever I see the phrase 40 committee, I think of Beefheart's phrase, there are only 40 people in the world and 5 of them are hamburgers. The 40 Committee was a phrase out of, I think, the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. So that might have been when Beefheart was looking into top-down stuff and heard about the 40 Committee and came up with this idea. There are only 40 people in the world. You're reflecting the real managers.
Uh-huh.
This establishment is a pastiche, somewhat like the late Meyer Lansky's corporate form of direction over U.S. organized crime, of various factional elements among the gods of Olympus. So pastiche is like a committee, a combination, a conglomerate.
Mm-hmm.
The establishment reaches decisions which determine the fate of individuals, governments, and nations. The official intelligence community merely executes the collective decisions reached within this establishment. So what LaRouche is, what he considers world government is the bureaucratic management of the word that makes the market. So he's seeing the imploded environment almost. But he thinks there's a bureaucratic committee running its policies, and that's probably true. That's the committee in the White House. But the White House, the advisors, the anonymous advisors to the White House, aren't Americans. They're an international gang.
Yeah.
So LaRouche is seeing the word that makes the market, but maybe bureaucratizing it too much as an international gang. If they're all discarnate inside this electronic singular membrane, then everybody and anybody is involved in the committee, because all the businesses around the world have to deal with it.
Mm. And the president's got to be at least as aware, if not more aware, than Casey.
Right. But LaRouche's metaphor for this Fondi committee, you know, Fondi, the oligarchic Venetian trust funds that go back hundreds of years, the idea that they're a committee or a pastiche is, as an establishment, is a way of talking about the human level of the word that makes the market.
Mm-hmm.
The resulting situation properly reminds us of Aeschylus's Prometheus Bound. You know, the Prometheus is a character that gets tries to take the fire of the gods and bring it back and make technology out of it, is LaRouche's interpretation. And he gets punished for it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the gods of Olympus are Malthusian anti-technology people. That's the feudalistic agenda of this world government that LaRouche is criticizing. So LaRouche says the highest level of understanding is to be Promethean. We did that, in, I think, earlier on the three levels of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So the resulting situation properly reminds us of Aeschylus' Prometheus Bound, and also one of Goethe's most successful poems, his Prometheus. In Aeschylus, Prometheus warns the gods of Olympus that there is a real god. There's the Christian part, non-pagan part of LaRouche, and that the Creator's world has embedded within it laws which shape the ultimate doom of whoever sets himself up as an Olympus in defiance of the Creator and his laws. In other words, you go towards a feudal direction, anti-technological scientific development, you're going to get the collapse. Now, LaRouche says this world government committee of oligarchs is satanic because they can profit from the collapse.